Good evening. Yes, I was doing something else, but now I'm here with you. You have my full and undivided attention. And may I say, you all look beautiful this evening, at least as you appear in this little pinhole camera that I'm staring at. Anyway, good evening and welcome to week three of Networks and the Digital Revolution, Economic Myths and Realities. It's hard to believe that we're already at the halfway point of the course, but I guess with a five-week course, the halfway point comes up pretty quickly. Now, normally, if this were one of my university classes, at the halfway point of the semester, I would encourage the students to start thinking about the final exam. Many of them would already be panicked about their grades, and there would be much weeping and gnashing of teeth. It's a little bit different with a course like this. We do have a final exam, and I encourage you to be thinking about it. It will be online. It will be a series of questions that are similar in spirit to the little quiz questions that we've had, but instead of multiple choice questions, they'll be short answer questions. Now, by short answer, I mean that a correct answer might be as little as two or three sentences. It might be a paragraph or even two paragraphs at most, but it wouldn't be any longer than that. In fact, we'll design the exam so it limits the amount that you can type in to the little boxes online so that I don't have to read any grand treatises. But, it's not writing an essay. It's not writing a term paper. It's really just providing short answers to some analytical questions. Questions where you have to think on your feet just a little bit, and you'll have a fairly generous window in which to take the exam. But once you start taking the exam, you'll have a limited time, maybe say 2 hours, in which to complete it. So the idea is, you'd look at the week following our last lecture, two Wednesdays from today, and you'd sort of block out a couple of hours of uninterrupted time when you can sit in front of the computer and take the exam. I'll be happy to answer any administrative questions about it as we get closer to the date. And Danny, of course, would be happy to do the same. But really, in a course like ours, as we're starting to, as we're at the halfway point, that's a good time for you to be thinking about potential follow-up. So maybe there are other subjects that you'd like to learn more about. Maybe there are other courses that you'd like to take. And at the Mises Academy, we are always interested in customer feedback, in knowing what you liked and what you didn't like, and you will have an opportunity to provide some more formalized feedback, sort of a course evaluation. But also, just informally, we'd like to know what else you'd like to do. Are there other courses that you would like us to offer? Would you like a repeat of this course or a slightly different version of this course? Are there other subjects and topics that you're interested in? Not necessarily taught by me, although I hope to do more Mises Academy teaching. It could be taught by anybody on the Academy staff, or if there are particular professors that you're interested in, maybe who haven't taught a Mises Academy course before, be sure and suggest those as well. So, I mean, it sounds kind of corny, as some, in the higher education business, as people sometimes do, to talk about, this being a journey and our course being the beginning rather than the end of your journey, and to use phrases that have kind of a postmodernist taint to them about starting a conversation and being part of a conversation. But, all kidding aside, there is something to it, and certainly all of us at the Mises Academy hope that this is, not the end of your learning experience with us, but it's just the beginning or the midpoint for some of you. We'll have opportunities to continue the discussion informally through the relationships that you're making and have already made and will continue to make. The Mises Wiki, of course, goes on in perpetuity, and there'll be opportunity to participate in the discussion forums here on the Moodle site for this particular course. It won't shut down as soon as the course is over. But if there are other more structured, more formal ways that you want to continue the discussion, please just let us know and we'll see what we can do to accommodate. Our main subject for today is network effects. We've already talked about networks, network effects, or network externalities, as they're sometimes known in the literature, earlier in the course. And I wanted to spend a little bit more time going over that in detail this week, and again, have some time for questions, comments, discussions, and so on at the end. So I'll give a little lecture here for hopefully, I don't know, 45 minutes, maybe a little bit longer. And feel free to jump in with questions or comments in the chat window at any time. And if I can address those on the spot, I will. Otherwise, I'll save them to the end and we'll talk about them in a more open, freeform session at the end. Okay. And obviously, please let me know if you're having any problems with the audio or the video or the visuals. The little diagram that you see in the title slide, that one actually is on the Moodle page as well, and I used it a couple days ago. It's supposed to illustrate so-called Metcalfe's Law, which we described last week or 2 weeks ago. You know, sort of a networking counterpoint or counterpart to Moore's Law, the more famous Moore's Law about kind of the increasing returns in technology. Metcalfe's Law doesn't refer to the value of something over time, but rather the value of a network as a function of the number of nodes in the network, right? Metcalfe's Law says, roughly speaking, the value of a network is proportional to the square of the number of nodes, not simply the number of nodes itself. So it's not that a network with 10 participants is twice as good as a network with 5 participants. No, it's orders of magnitude greater than the older network. So the smaller network. So a 5-person network, you know, has a value equal to 25, and a 10-person network has a value equal to 100. Okay, that's the way Metcalfe, Stan Metcalfe is his name, important network engineer, kind of described the problem. And that's a very useful way, certainly a neat visual way, to think about why people care so much about networks, why they've cared about them in the past, and why they seem to care about them so much now. So it won't surprise you that, that I'm going to begin by, throwing a little splash of cold water on the network hype. Okay, so I'm not going to claim tonight that networks don't matter, that networks aren't important, that the internet as a big network, a so-called network of networks, is just sort of a trivial thing. No, I get to say that next week. No, I'm just kidding. These things are important. Of course they're important. But like the other phenomena that we've been talking about over the last few weeks, networks, the value of networks, the importance of networks, and even network effects or network externalities, the idea that the value of being in the network depends on how many other people are already in the network, leading to interesting issues about first mover advantages and tipping points and so on, none of that is really very new. Right? Economists have been thinking and writing and speaking about networks, even if they didn't use the modern terminology, since the very beginning of any systematic thinking about economics at all. Right, so go back to the most basic, most fundamental ideas about, about markets, about exchange, about trade, right? The science of economics, or the study of markets, what Mises called catalactics, is ultimately about exchange. It's about purposeful human actors, individual decision makers, seeking to make themselves better off, as Mises put it, to remove felt uneasiness by exchanging with other people, more generally by interacting with other agents, right? The basic principle of exchange, or law of exchange as it's sometimes put, is the idea that voluntary exchange is mutually beneficial, right? When I exchange, bread for meat, I value the thing I'm getting, the meat, more highly than the thing I'm giving up, the bread. And likewise, the person I'm trading with must have the inverse or reciprocal valuations, valuing the thing they get more than the thing they give up. Otherwise, they would not have agreed to participate in the exchange to begin with, right? So the fact that people are willing to engage in exchange indicates that they, at least they expect in ex ante terms, to be made better off from participating in the exchange, okay? You know, two important caveats, right? First, this general principle of exchange does not presume omniscience, right? People could make errors, right? They could mistakenly participate in an exchange they thought would make themselves better off, and they discover later down the road that they have some regret, they don't like the thing they purchased as much as they expected to, and, you know, and so on. That of course doesn't invalidate the principle that people participate in exchange because in a subjective, purposeful way, they expect to be made better off by participating in that exchange. The other thing, tying into our discussion last week on information goods, is to note that what human actors buy and sell in trading relationships is discrete marginal units of goods and services, right? They don't buy and sell information, they buy and sell specific goods and services, which might embody information or correspond to amounts of information. But it isn't abstract things that are traded, it's specific, discrete, marginal units of things that are traded, okay? You know, from the earliest systematic thinking about markets, it was quickly realized that the value of participating in a market, in other words, the value of being part of a network of exchange relationships, depends on the size of the network. Adam Smith used the term, and the British classical economists popularized the term, the division of labor, right? A society with a more advanced division of labor, in other words, a society in which individuals specialize and exchange with other people who also specialize and exchange, is more productive, is more efficient, is more desirable than a society in which people are self-sufficient. Right, and those of you who've taken a basic economics course have heard this idea many, many times before, right? If people try to be self-sufficient and to produce all of the goods they themselves consume, they're limited by the amount, it simply isn't possible to produce and consume as many goods as would be available if one specializes in one or a small number of goods and then trades with other people who also specialize in one or a small number of goods. That's the idea of a division of labor within an economy or within a society. People specialize, presumably in things in which they have some skill, right, and they exchange with other people who are also specialized, and everyone can have more stuff. We can all consume more stuff when we specialize and trade than we can if we try to be self-sufficient. So a society with an advanced, complex, well-developed division of labor is better off, is a better society, a more productive and efficient society than one in which people try to be self-sufficient. David Ricardo coined the term comparative advantage to go even further in explaining why the division of labor is beneficial. And many of you have heard the principle of comparative advantage explained at the level of economies or countries. Right, it's often brought up in the context of international trade, thinking about tariffs and quotas and other forms of subsidy or protection, right? Is it better for each country to try to be self-sufficient in all of the major commodities and services that it needs rather than be exposed to, you know, sort of, or rather than being dependent on other countries with whom to trade? What if other countries, what if one country is not, doesn't have good land or doesn't have skilled labor, then it wants to avoid being exploited by more advanced countries that have skilled labor and better resources, right? Well, Ricardo famously demonstrated that no, that's not true, that even countries that are relatively poor, or we should say especially for countries that are not well endowed with natural resources or skilled labor, those countries are in particular made better off by participating in the international division of labor in world markets, right? Even if France is better at producing, you know, at making wine and in baking bread than England, the English are still better off by specializing in the goods in which they have what Ricardo called a comparative advantage than those, and trading with people in other countries who have comparative advantages in other things. I like the way Mises explained Ricardo's principle of comparative advantage, which Mises renamed the law of association to stress its generality, to stress that it applies not only to countries engaged in international trade, but also to individuals participating in the market, right? And, you know, the sort of example that Mises had in mind was, imagine a physician, a doctor, who is not only a skilled physician, but it also, you know, is also very good at, you know, cleaning the surgical instruments. Mises pointed out that such a physician, a surgeon, let's say, might still want to hire an assistant to clean the instruments, to to prepare the operating room for surgery, even if that assistant cannot do those jobs as well as the surgeon. Why? Because the surgeon's skills are relatively more suited for performing surgery than they are for cleaning the surgical instruments. For example, the surgeon might be twice as good as the assistant in cleaning the instruments, but 10 or 20 or 100 times as good at performing surgery. Thus, by delegating to the assistant responsibility for cleaning the instruments, the surgeon frees him or herself up to perform activities in which he or she is even more better than the assistant, than those tasks that the assistant is given to do, right? So even though the assistant, in absolute terms, is worse both at surgery and at cleaning the instruments, the assistant has what Ricardo called a comparative advantage in cleaning the instruments. In other words, the assistant is absolutely worse in both things, but is not quite as bad relative to the surgeon at cleaning instruments as performing surgery. Therefore, the assistant should specialize in cleaning surgical instruments and hire him or herself out to a surgeon who specializes in performing surgery. Even the surgeon is better off by exchanging with an assistant who really isn't that good at anything compared to the surgeon, right? What Mises wanted to argue is that participation in the division of labor is not just for the skilled. It's not only those who have really great things to offer who benefit from participating in the division of labor. No, even those who really aren't very good at anything have a role to play in the division of labor, even if all they're doing is freeing up other people from performing particularly menial tasks so that those other people can focus and specialize on the things in which they're really, really good. Mises, you know, writes in Human Action about this basic law of association being kind of the most fundamental of all social relationships. So in contrast to a kind of Marxist view in which the fundamental basic social relationships are subjugation, exploitation, dominance of the strong, dominance of the weak by the strong, and so on, Mises emphasizes instead that society is essentially about kind of harmonious relationships, that the most fundamental relationships in society are those of mutual benefit and mutual gain. That's why societies are formed. That's why people participate as members of society rather than being hermits, you know, who live in their own little caves like Osama bin Laden, or live in a, you know, in a shack in the wilderness like the Unabomber a decade or so ago. Joe Salerno has written some very interesting articles on the socialist calculation debate. Some of you may be familiar with those. What I want to call to your attention is how Salerno uses the term social appraisement process to describe what it is that entrepreneurs do when they try to evaluate factors of production. Mises' basic argument about why socialism wouldn't work is that if the state owns all the factors of production, the state owns all the land, all the factories, all the equipment, the machines, the state is responsible for guiding or directing all the workers, then there's no way for state planners to allocate those resources in ways that will satisfy consumer wants. Why? Because if the state owns all factors, then there can be no markets for factors of production by definition. Therefore, there are no entrepreneurs who are buying and selling factors, who are trading their judgment about factor use in the market, leading to the formation of factor market prices. Right? In a market economy, factors of production, land, labor, capital, and so on, are allocated through the price mechanism. In the absence of private property in factors, there can be no factor markets, and hence no prices for factors of production at all, and no way for anybody to know what's the most efficient use of a particular factor or combination of factors. This process in which entrepreneurs, using their specific knowledge, as we talked about last time, compete against each other for the acquisition and deployment of factors, leading to the formation of factor prices, which other entrepreneurs can use in doing their own business planning. Salerno describes this as a process of appraisement. So the factors of production are evaluated or appraised by entrepreneurs competing against each other in factor markets. Without private ownership of factors, there can be no social appraisement process. The central planners are not able to take advantage of the division of knowledge in a complex advanced society. So even when thinking about socialism and why socialism doesn't work, the Austrian economists were ultimately talking about network phenomena. The more technologically advanced a society, the greater the population, the greater the potential variety of resources that can be used to produce consumer goods, the larger the network of entrepreneurs participating in the social appraisement process. And therefore, the more important it is to have a free market for factors, to take advantage of this increasingly large and sophisticated network. In other words, market exchange has always been about networks. And the value of market exchange depends on the number of people and other characteristics, the number of people participating in market exchange. So the idea of network effects is just really restating the basic principles of specialization, trade, and the division of labor. Now, it turns out that when we look at specific institutions that have emerged through the market, the Austrian economists, among others, have actually done quite a lot of analysis of these particular institutions using the language and terminology of network theory or network effects. One of the best known examples is Karl Menger's well-known paper published in English in 1892 on the emergence of money. How, Menger argued, do particular commodities tend to become adopted as media of exchange in a market setting, right? So if one looks, looking back at history on the kinds of commodities that have been used as money, we find a lot of different commodities in the historical record, right? Seashells in Polynesia, tobacco leaves in the American colonies, cattle in parts of Africa. Even today, cattle are used in some parts of the world, or livestock are used as media of exchange. But as we all know from, if you've taken a course in monetary economics, the kinds of commodities that historically have tended to become the dominant media of exchange are precious metals, like silver and in particular gold. So why is it that one commodity rather than another tends to become a dominant medium of exchange? Well, Menger explained this. He explained how money emerges on the market through the actions of large numbers of individuals in the absence of any kind of central coordination or central planning. And Menger's story is basically one of network effects. Menger says that one can perform a thought experiment in which people are, you know, engaged in direct exchange of goods for goods, so-called barter, right? You trade a loaf of bread for, you know, for a bottle of wine. You trade some clothing for late construction services and so on. One can imagine a primitive society without money in which all exchange is conducted through barter. But there are a number of difficulties, technical problems associated with a barter economy, the most famous being the so-called double coincidence of wants. Right? If I have bread and want wine, I have to find somebody who has the kind of wine I want in the appropriate units and who wants the kind of bread I have. And it may be very difficult to find trading partners who can participate in these binary or one-on-one exchanges. Right, that's what Mises calls direct exchange. It's far better to rely on indirect exchange, right? Maybe I can find, if we have an intermediate good like seashells, right? Maybe I can find someone who's willing to accept bread in exchange for seashells. Then I find a winemaker who is willing to take seashells in exchange for wine. So if we have a certain commodity like seashells, that everyone in the community is willing to buy and sell, then we eliminate this problem of finding people who have the same, you know, who have the reciprocal or inverse preferences that we have. But why, according to Menger, why seashells? Right? Maybe it could be some other commodity. In fact, maybe lots of commodities are used at any one time as intermediate goods. But to qualify as money, right? We're looking for a general medium of exchange, a good or service that is widely accepted within a certain community, is accepted in exchange for all goods and services, right? Well, why seashells? Why not some other kind of rocks? Why not livestock? Why not particular kinds of leaves or whatever? Why not coins? Well, Menger said, look, imagine a society in which there are multiple media of exchange in circulation. You know, some people use seashells, some people use precious metals, some people use cattle, whatever. Now, when I go to make a particular exchange, let's say that I find someone who's willing to give me seashells in exchange for the goods that I want. And then someone else is willing to buy those seashells, or willing to accept those seashells in exchange for the good or service that they have. So myself and a particular trading partner decide to use seashells as our medium of exchange. Well, imagine a third party who's sort of watching this, trying to decide what commodity he or she should use in their own exchanges. And they observe myself and my trading partner using seashells. So they think, huh, well, you know, I was about to flip a coin and choose between seashells and tobacco leaves, but because I see some other people around me using seashells, yeah, maybe I'll use seashells too. I'm slightly more confident that seashells will be accepted by my next potential trading partner because I've seen this one particular group use seashells. And so that person, that third party, decides to use seashells. Then the next person who comes along sees that, you know, two particular exchanges that went before, or learns that two exchanges from before use seashells, and that person decides on the margin to use seashells rather than tobacco, and so on and so forth. Right, so eventually, over time, one particular commodity tends to become adopted as the universal medium of exchange because in a step-by-step fashion, other people have, you know, tended to observe this commodity being used in the past. Essentially, that was Menger's story about the evolution of money. And if you've never read Menger's 1892 article, it's well worth reading. It's very easy to read and clear and straightforward, even though it's over 100 years old. Some of you might recognize this kind of story that I'm telling as an example, and sort of a general example of what Hayek called spontaneous order, right? How kind of coordinated action, the use of a particular standard, for example, can emerge without sort of a central committee choosing or the society getting together and deciding. Right, that's a critical part of Menger's story, that in Menger's theoretical mechanism, it's not that the elders of the community get together or the entire, you know, male population gets together or something and says, gee, we see people all over the community using lots of different medium of exchange. That doesn't make any sense, right? That's a waste of time. We need to have one commodity. Let's vote on what it is, or the king will just tell us what it is. No, there's no explicit collective decision making in that form in Menger's story. It's an incremental, spontaneous, bottom-up, emergent process leading to one commodity beating the others out and becoming the dominant medium of exchange. Hayek wrote about, used similar reasoning in his discussion of the English common law, which Hayek very much was in favor of. If you've read Hayek's work on law, particularly his 1973 trilogy, Law, Legislation, and Liberty, you see his emphasis on the common law as another example, like money, of sort of, you know, common standards that emerge in a voluntary, decentralized, you know, emergent process. Hayek is building in particular on an important book by an Italian legal scholar named Bruno Leoni, who published a 1960 book, Freedom and the Law, making these arguments very explicitly about sort of common law emerging in this bottom-up fashion, as opposed to legislation or statutory law, which is the rules that are produced by legislatures and kings, which are top-down. And Leone argues that bottom-up common law tends to be, Leone draws an analogy between, he says sort of common law is like the market, statutory law or legislation is like top-down central planning. It's a very interesting treatment of why common law, emergent law, might be more desirable than statutory law or sort of top-down government law. There's some very interesting work by the late Harold Berman, a very important legal scholar, and also Bruce Benson, an economist at Florida State University, on commercial law, what was called the law merchant in medieval days, which referred to sort of voluntary private codes governing commercial exchange that had the force of law in terms of being enforced and being recognized, but the enforcement was all voluntary by merchants. Those in violation of the law would be punished with ostracism and so on. Those of you who read in the anarcho-capitalist literature are probably familiar with this and will recognize this treatment of commercial law as an example, a sort of a voluntary set of standards that can emerge on the market. Indeed, the language, the emergence of a common language, English, French, Spanish, and so on, programming languages, culture, social norms, can all be similarly treated as examples of spontaneous orders. Right, so when we talk about telecommunications networks, the telegraph, the telephone, the fax machine, the internet, instant messaging, social networking platforms, and so on, as having these kind of characteristics, right, that A, the value of participating in these networks depends on how many other people are also in the network, B, I guess I should say two, right, that these networks do not require sort of top-down central planning, but adoption is voluntary, and characteristics of the networks emerge in sort of a bottom-up fashion. Again, this is not something that is unique to modern internet technology, right? Network effects are very general. They're sort of a fundamental, basic aspect of human society. They've been discussed by economists and other social scientists and historians, you know, for many, many decades, for centuries even. And, you know, as we kind of work through the stuff in Stan Liebowitz's article and the encyclopedia piece on path dependence, as we talk about those issues, you know, I want you to remember that this is nothing totally radical or revolutionary in the sense that we need, you know, a whole new kind of economic theory to explain it. Okay? Yeah, some of you have some good citations in the chat room to some references on these topics, some of Benson's works. Per Bielen's paper, you know, I would also recommend, although Per is my PhD student, so you should take everything he says or writes with a grain of salt. Now, remember last time we talked about positive feedback, right? And this notion of tipping, that in markets with positive feedback, where the value of a particular product or service in the market depends on its share of the market, right? You can easily have markets that sort of tip from seemingly, you know, random events, you know, to one product or commodity or another, leading to these kind of, not necessarily winner take all, but maybe winner take most sorts of markets. And, you know, some of you may know the term from chaos theory, what's sometimes called the butterfly effect, right? And I don't mean that goofy movie with Ashton, what's his name, but the notion of a butterfly effect in chaos theory, you've probably heard this term used in the context of climate science, right? You know, the idea that a butterfly flapping its wings, you know, somewhere off in China can affect, you know, the snowfall in Denmark because the, you know, climate systems are so made up of so many interdependent elements that very, very small, seemingly random effects in one part can have huge effects throughout the entire system. Well, you know, thinking about technology markets, one of the reasons that people have found the winner-take-most markets so interesting, and for some people, you know, worrisome, is because seemingly small random effects can make the market tip in one particular direction. Remember my example with the seashells, right? I mean, maybe there's, you know, 10 different commodities that have some potential as media of exchanges, and each one of them is being used by exactly the same number of people. And so when I decide to make my exchange, let's say I just flip a coin. Well, wait a minute, or would I flip a seashell? Well, whatever. In other words, I randomly choose one particular commodity over another, just completely at random. And I choose that one. And then that one has a little teeny bit of a head start. Then the next person who comes along trying to decide what commodity to use sees that one commodity has a teeny, teeny bit of a bigger market share than the others because of my random choice. And so they choose that one, and so on and so forth. And so the market ends up converging or tipping to a particular commodity or standard, not because it's best in some objective sense, but because of a butterfly effect, because of some small random incident. Okay, we'll come back to that point in just a moment, but keep that in mind. We talked last time about different sources on the supply side and the demand side of positive feedback. And also, we'll focus in particular today on so-called network effects. You know, why are they so important? Why do people care so much about all this? Well, it's, you know, because the internet is a big network, a network of networks, people think that you know, network effects are sort of what have driven the growth of the internet and other kinds of networks. Right? One of the reasons that people demand so much technology, hardware, software, networking protocols, services, and so on. One of the reasons that so many entrepreneurs are willing to supply technology is because of network effects, right? Because you want to be part of a big network. The more people who are on the internet, the more important it is to, you know, to buy internet services, to produce internet services, and so on. And there's kind of a chicken and egg issue, right? Entrepreneurs don't want to produce products, or put it another way, programmers don't want to write code for programs that don't have a large number of users. The people don't want to start using a particular program until the code is good enough to make it worthwhile. So that's where you get this sort of positive feedback or virtuous cycle, but how do you get it started in the first place? That's the challenge. Network effects explain why in so many technology markets we have dominant standards or platforms, right? Microsoft dominates the market for desktop operating system. Google dominates the market for search. Facebook dominates the market for, you know, social networking services. Twitter dominates you know, short messaging services, and so on, right? We have competition among wireless companies. But in most markets, there's, you know, kind of an oligopoly of maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 mobile network operators, but not rarely very many more than that. And as we talked about last time, firms use particular strategies to try to take advantage of network effects or to compete in markets with network effects, like trying to seize the first mover advantage. So the market will be more likely to tip in your favor, right? And also, we talked about the importance of so-called installed base, right? Which might imply, in other words, a large number of people who are kind of loyal to your product or committed to your product, which might involve giving it away for free, right? Well, I used Adobe Acrobat as an example before, giving away Acrobat Reader for free to make money by selling the technology that makes PDF documents. But you can think of Twitter and Facebook as examples too, or even internet search, right? Twitter is free to use, Facebook is free to use, not because the owners of these firms are altruists, but because they want to make money by offering complementary services like advertising. And the way to make the most money by advertising is to have the biggest number of users, which means you give the end product away to the consumer for free, okay? Now, let's talk specifically about network effects, path dependence, and lock-in. I think the two articles do a pretty good job of explaining the basic mechanism. So all I need to do here is just highlight a few things. Some of the key figures in this debate include people like Paul David and Brian Arthur on the sort of market failure side, Stan Liebowitz and his co-author Stephen Margolis on the other side of the issue. There are other important economists like Michael Katz and Carl Shapiro, the same Shapiro who co-authored Information Rules. They wrote a number of papers in the 1980s and 90s on path dependence. Joseph Farrell and Garth Saloner, two other neoclassical economists who have written about this. And the basic argument, I'm sure you already know. If a market is characterized by strong network effects, then the argument goes, the firms that do best in the market are not necessarily those that produce the products and services that consumers desire, that are the most economically efficient, and so on. Rather, they're the ones that just got lucky, or maybe they were particularly unscrupulous in their marketing or business strategies, and they ended up becoming the dominant players. Not because their products are best, but because they took advantage of network externalities, right? The QWERTY keyboard being the most famous example. There's lots in the readings about QWERTY, right? The basic claim is that the QWERTY keyboard layout is not the best one, right? It's the one that happened to win in some of these early typing contests, and because in the early days of typing, manufacturers wanted to adopt use the same keyboard layout that other people knew how to type on, and people learning to type wanted to train themselves on the platform that typewriters were using, and you get the same sort of chicken and egg virtuous cycle thing that we talked about before with programming. And so you end up with a dominant standard QWERTY, even though it's not any good, according to the critics, right? So the critics are kind of implicitly recognizing sort of the standard arguments about the market, right? That when firms are free to compete against each other, when entrepreneurs are competing to satisfy consumer wants, what Mises called consumer sovereignty obtains, right? The entrepreneurs who succeed are the ones who are the best at satisfying consumer wants. People like Paul David and Brian Arthur said, no, the market fails when network effects are present, because then the products that win out, that tend to dominate the market, that have the largest share of the market, are those that happen to go first, or those that, because of some butterfly effect, happen to have the market tip in their favor. We cannot assume that the ones that win are the best. Or to put it differently, the market is not very good at choosing technical standards. Okay? So whatever standard comes to be the dominant one, we as consumers and as entrepreneurs as well, we get stuck. We're locked in to a particular technology like QWERTY, and so we go down a path that we can't break out of. Right? Even if we all recognize that QWERTY was no good and that something else would be better, there's a very difficult problem of coordination. You don't want to be the only one who switches from QWERTY to something else, although of course you can switch to Dvorak or some alternative layout. It's very easy to do it now with software, right? But most people don't want to learn Dvorak because everybody else they know uses QWERTY. And this, you know, most PCs are set up by default with QWERTY, and you don't want to be the odd man out, right? Another good example of this kind of network effect would be which side of the road you drive on, right? So in most parts of the world, you drive on the right, but in the United Kingdom, in Japan, Australia, New Zealand, a few other places, you drive on the left. And, you know, aside from the cost of putting steering wheels on one side or the other, you know, it really doesn't matter whether everybody drives on the left or everybody drives on the right, as long as everybody adopts the same standard, right? It would be very difficult to have kind of a slow, gradual, step-by-step, change from driving on the left to driving on the right. The interesting story, the Nordic countries, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark, they actually switched. They switched fairly recently in the 1960s from driving on the left-hand side to driving on the right-hand side, and they sort of did it by decree, right? They had some sort of ballot measure, a national vote, and it was decided that, you know, on the stroke of midnight on January 1st of whatever year, we're going to switch from driving on the left to driving on the right. You can only do it if everybody agrees to do it at the same time, although I still would not have wanted to be, you know, driving around midnight on that first day. So, you know, the idea is, because of network effects, we get stuck on the wrong path and we can't break out of it, even if we want to. Even if everybody would be made better off using Dvorak or using, you know, AC rather than DC power, or using one different gauge of railroad track versus another, or using steam engines rather than internal combustion engines, you know, you just can't get to that. We can't make ourselves better off because we can't coordinate in a decentralized fashion. You know, the obvious implication is that we need the state, right? We need the government to coordinate for us, either by picking standards in the beginning or by forcing us to switch from one standard to another. Another sort of very contemporary example of this is electric cars. So there's all this excitement about the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt or whatever, not hybrids, but these 100% electric cars. And you can see there's a network effect problem, right? Nobody wants to buy an electric car unless there are refueling stations that are, you know, located, you know, they're densely located in the areas where you drive, right? But no entrepreneur wants to build refueling stations if there are only a handful of electric cars. So again, you have this sort of chicken and egg problem. Now, market participants, it turns out, are very clever at finding ways to encourage this sort of coordination without government central planning. And we'll say, I'll say more about that in just a moment. But the basic idea, according to Paul David and Brian Arthur and so on, are that network effects constitute a source of market failure. When networks effects are present, the market doesn't get it right. The market doesn't work. The market can't be trusted and so on. And therefore, you need the government to choose the standards. You need some sort of licensing board or industry board to set the standard and so on. Otherwise, we'll get typewriters with the wrong format. We'll get the wrong power supply. We'll end up with the wrong kind of video cassettes. Some of you remember the old VHS versus Betamax debate or battle, which was echoed much more recently by Blu-ray and HD DVD. The Mac OS versus PC, the IBM, you know, PC, MS-DOS. These are all examples, it is argued by the critics, where the market chose the wrong standard, where the market failed. Did the market really fail? Well, it turns out there are some important responses or counter arguments to those from Paul David and Brian Arthur and other and people in that crowd. And let me just mention a number of these arguments. I mean, first, we might I mean, I think it's useful to begin by sort of conceding the point that, you know, it may very well be true that markets sometimes converge on a standard that ex post market participants may regret, right? People may be sitting around saying, gee, I wish that HD DVD had won out over Blu-ray, or I wish we were all driving electric cars instead of, you know, gasoline powered cars. Well, you know, in part, that's just ex post regret, right? And we all experience ex post regret, or we may experience ex post regret in a number of different circumstances, right? So keep in mind that when typewriters were first introduced, or in the early days of the automobile, or when high definition, you know, DVDs were first coming onto the market, nobody really knew what the best standard would be, okay? Human actors are not omniscient. They don't have perfect knowledge, and they may end up regretting their choices ex post, individually or collectively. But it doesn't follow from that that government standard setting or that some other alternative mechanism for choosing standards would do any better, right? How would government planners know in the early days of self-propelled vehicles whether the steam engine or the electric engine or the internal combustion engine, you know, would 100 years later be considered best? How would the government have known? How would an industry board have known in the early days what consumers will end up preferring down the road? We have to be careful not to commit what Harold Demsetz called the Nirvana fallacy. In other words, we don't want to compare real-world outcomes to some hypothetical perfect outcome that would have obtained in a perfect world, right? Because we don't have a perfect world. That's not on the table. We can only choose among feasible alternatives. And it's very difficult to argue that the government is less likely to have, you know, to make errors of imperfect knowledge than the market, which, as we've already seen, aggregates the knowledge of many, many participants. You know, there's also the fact, look, even if we all agreed that it would be better to have Dvorak than QWERTY, you know, if the benefits of switching are small and the costs of switching are substantial because you have this coordination chicken and egg problem, well, then maybe what we have is good enough, right? If transition costs or switching costs are taken into account, then the status quo, even if not as good as some hypothetical ideal, you know, may be just as good as anything else that we can achieve. So there's no market failure, right? Even a second best standard is efficient once we take into account the switching costs, if the switching costs are big enough. Oliver Williamson uses the term remediableness to say that, you know, any imperfect situation, if it isn't remediable, meaning you can't actually change it and realize net gains, then the status quo is efficient in that sense, in sort of a constrained second best notion of efficiency. Someone mentioned public choice in the chat room. That's exactly right. If we think about the political process, right? Imagine that we task a government agency with setting technology standards. Is that agency more or less likely to choose, you know, the wrong standards? Well, look, if we know anything at all about politics, if we know anything from public choice theory, it's that political processes are much more likely to suffer from path dependence and lock-in than market processes, right? I mean, what standards is the government board likely to choose? Well, the ones that it chose before, or the ones that are supported by interest groups who benefited from prior standards and so on. I mean, if we think path dependence is likely to be a problem anywhere, it's much more likely to be a problem for the political process than it is for any market process that we can imagine. Okay, there's another issue that I think is worth, is a little bit more subtle, but is worth pointing out, another theoretical issue, is that sometimes the network effect or network externality crowd does not fully take into account the notion of marginal impact or small marginal changes. So imagine that I want to write my own operating system, or I want to create my own search engine, okay? Well, you know, I'm not going to compete with Microsoft or Google, you know, head to head, right? Say I want to create a social networking site. Well, I'm not going to be able to start my own, you know, Peter book and have it, or Klein book, and have it be just as good as Facebook and have just as many users as Facebook because of the network effect, right? People don't want to join Peter book, and advertisers don't want to advertise on Peter book if it only has, you know, three users, myself, my wife, and Per Bieland, you know, whom I would force to have an account. Nobody's going to want to be on a platform like that. Well, but how can I get the money from investors to develop my platform if it has so few users, right? So we're back to this chicken and egg thing. But listen, maybe I start out with more modest ambitions, right? I don't want to have a gazillion users the way Facebook has. I don't want to produce a general social networking platform. Maybe I want to have a social networking site for Austrian economists interested in technology studies. And say there's like 10 such people. Well, okay, there's all of you in this class. Maybe we set up a social networking site just for people in this class. Okay? And it's pretty small. It only has, say, you know, 24 users. But it's cool. We're able to do some things. You know, we like being able to network in a smaller setting than Facebook. We don't want to deal with all the crap on Facebook. We want a small, devoted, highly specialized social networking platform. And it's good enough and cheap enough that, you know, it's worth it for just the 24 of us. Well, you know, one more person enters the scene, and is choosing among social networking platforms. And yeah, they have a Facebook account, but Facebook doesn't really do everything they want it to do. They want access to a more specialized crowd. And so they decide to join Peterbook. And maybe there's an advertiser who's targeting our specific user base and decides to put a small ad on Peterbook. And, you know, it gets a teeny bit bigger. And then the next day it gets a teeny bit bigger and a teeny bit bigger and so on. Look, it may be 10 years, 100 years, or never before the social networking market, you know, tips to where Peterbook becomes the dominant standard, but it doesn't have to be the dominant standard to be viable. In other words, even in the presence of network effects, there is room for niche products and niche services or niche platforms. Right? I like, you know, think about automobiles. Most people want to drive a Toyota or a Honda or a Chevrolet. But if you have a taste for a very specialized, esoteric kind of vehicle, you can get one. You can buy a kit car over the internet. If you're rich, you can buy a Lamborghini or a Rolls Royce or another small market car. Cheap people can get scooters and dirt bikes and all kinds of small market specialized transportation commodities. In other words, you don't have to be as big as Chevrolet, as big as Honda, as big as Toyota to be viable as an automobile producer. That's the beauty of the market, that it caters to many, many different kinds of tastes. It's not like democratic elections that are winner-take-all. Right? Politics is where you have tipping and winner-take-all problems, not the market, even in the presence of network effects. So on the margin, even in a market with strong network effects, small competitors can emerge, can prosper, can grow, and maybe eventually become big enough to take on the incumbents, okay? But I think the, you know, the Leibowitz and Margolis stuff is extremely important in challenging the factual empirical claims made by the network externality crowd, right? And the famous article called The Fable of the Keys, published in the Journal of Law and Economics, sort of went through step by step and took apart most of Paul David's empirical claims about QWERTY, right? That there was very little evidence, objective evidence, that QWERTY is actually all that bad compared to the alternatives, right? And they hilariously pointed out that Paul David relied very heavily on a U.S. Navy study to demonstrate the superiority of Dvorak over QWERTY, a Navy study that was written by Mr. Dvorak. Right? Obviously not an objective source of information. So they point out, it's really not at all clear that any feasible alternative in the early days of typing was any better than QWERTY. And the same thing is true if you look at VHS versus Beta, and you know the Mac versus IBM PC. I'm on my, a couple slides back or the previous slide, I had a picture of one of the old Macintoshes, the first Macintosh from 1984. One of the classic network externality arguments, right, is that, the old, think of the old days of the PC in the 80s, those of you who can remember, when you had to, type at a command prompt, dir/p, C:// and all that stuff, and what a pain that was, and how Apple came along with its revolutionary graphical user interface with the mouse and point and click, and how superior that was. Well, I mean, it's true that a good graphical user interface is much better for most, though not all, tasks than typing at the command prompt. But guys, I was there. I can remember. I was a college student in 1984. And I remember one of the kids in my dorm had a Mac, had one of the first Macs, and we all sat around and marveled at it and oohed and aahed, and we played with it and we tried to figure out, what the mouse was and how you click and how it all works. It was a really, really neat toy. However, it was very expensive, much more expensive than rival PC clones. It was extremely slow. It took forever to repaint the windows. I mean, the hardware of its day really just wasn't up to the demands of the software. And so, for practical purposes, for business people who wanted to create documents and collect data and use spreadsheets and analyze databases and so on, a Mac was pretty much useless for doing those kinds of tasks. It was okay for some, for graphic design, the being slow and clunky and expensive. That wasn't enough to take away from the advantages of the graphical user interface and, what you see is what you get typing and so on. But for most applications, the Mac just really wasn't any good. Now, when people say, the Mac was far superior, but it couldn't get a toehold in the early days because of network effects, what they mean is, the Mac was superior from a computer science point of view, or from an engineering point of view. It was more sophisticated. It was provided a more elegant solution to different kinds of computing problems than the MS-DOS solution. But as I said in week one of the course, we're talking about economics here, not engineering. Okay, so the Mac may have been superior in an engineering sense, but it wasn't superior in the early days in an economic sense, meaning it simply was not as good from the point of view of the typical consumer of that product performing their typical tasks as the simpler, more cheaper alternative of a monochrome screen and typing at the command prompt. Okay, the same is true if we look at railway gauges and video cassette formats and so on. The Betamax format was more elegant in the sense that it was a smaller tape and it could store more hours. Was a higher quality picture, but the machines were more expensive. The first generation of Betamax tapes could only record 30 minutes, where the first generation of VHS tapes were all larger and clunkier and having a lower picture quality could record for much longer, 2 hours. And then they introduced newer slow formats where they could record up to 6 hours. And, consumers choosing between VHS and Betamax decided that they preferred a longer recording time and less expensive machines over a more compact cassette and a higher quality picture, right? Engineers may think that Betamax was superior because, according to their criteria, but why should consumers prefer the same things that engineers prefer? From the consumer's point of view, VHS was the superior format. So in the case of the typewriter keyboard, in the case of the personal computer, in the case of video cassettes, it's not at all clear that the format that won out is in any way inferior to the alternative standards in the real economic sense of providing benefits or utility to consumers. I think it's also worth pointing out why network effects are not necessarily an externality. if you've taken other sort of neoclassical economics courses, you've probably heard the term externality. Okay, everybody. Good evening. Yes, I was doing something else, but now I'm here with you. You have my full and undivided attention. And may I say, you all look beautiful. Anyone? Anyone? Bueller? Bueller? Are we still there? You got audio and video? Okay. Yeah, skip for just a minute. So the idea of an externality, right, is when one party's actions have an effect on other parties, effects that are not taken into account by the actor, right? You know, pollution being the textbook example, a factory is producing steel and it's not taking into account the fact that its production is also doing damage to, you know, farmers in the surrounding fields because the smoke from the factory causes damage to those fields. So there's an external cost that the factory owners are not taking into account. And the, you know, sort of neoclassical welfare economics holds that these externalities cause inefficient levels of production. The factory produces too many cars or too much steel because it does not take into account the effects on other parties. In the case of so-called positive externalities, production is inefficiently low because producers do not take into account the positive effects of their actions on other people, right? You don't, mow your grass as often as you should because you don't take into account the fact that your neighbors also benefit when your grass is neatly mown. And because you can't charge them for the privilege of looking at your grass, you aren't able to capture that external benefit, and therefore you don't mow your grass often enough. The point here is that what Paul David and so on routinely describes as a network externality is not necessarily an externality in the sense that when you choose to use one standard or another, you don't fully capture the benefits and costs of your choice. Right? What they have in mind is that when I choose to use Blu-ray over HD DVD, that makes Blu-ray, gives Blu-ray a slightly larger share of the market than HD DVD, and other people who own Blu-ray devices are better off somehow because of my choice to buy a Blu-ray device. And I can't make those other people pay me, so I'm not really taking all the benefits and costs into account when I make my choice of what player to buy, and that's inefficient, that's bad, the government should intervene, blah, 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 blah. Well, if we actually look at the data, right, in the early days of typing, most people did not own a typewriter at home, right? And the typical typist was not just a regular person making their own individual decision about what kind of typewriter to buy. No, typing was typically done by large groups of typists in large companies organized into so-called typing pools. You can see a picture there on the slide of one of these old typing pools from the 1950s. In other words, the typists were not making their own individual decisions about what typing, what keyboard layout to use without taking into account the effects of their choices on other people. No, it was large companies that were telling all of its typists which kind of format to use. These big typing pools run by entrepreneurs were purchasing the typewriters and deciding what kind of typewriters to get and how the typist should type. So the companies were paying the training costs for these typists. So, it isn't the case, Paul David says, even if I know that Dvorak is superior, I'm not going to pay the costs of buying a Dvorak keyboard and training myself to use Dvorak because, it isn't worth it for me on my own to do that. It would only be worth it if everybody would do it. And nobody on their own will do it unless the government does it for them. But no, it wasn't individual typists who were making these decisions. It was the managers and directors of these typing pools. Therefore, and Deirdre McCloskey has used this illustration too, if Dvorak were really better than QWERTY, if the claims of Dvorak enthusiasts that you can type, you know, so much faster and with so many fewer errors if you use Dvorak instead of QWERTY. If those claims were really true, then it would have paid a company to retrain all its typists, to reconfigure all its typewriters, and bear those costs up front, but then realize huge gains down the road. In other words, within a typing pool, the externality is fully internalized, right? The benefits of one person switching are fully captured by the owner of the typing pool. But we don't know any example in history of a company switching its typing pool from QWERTY to something else, suggesting that the alleged benefits of switching to an alternative format really aren't that big, okay? So, in other words, network effects are not necessarily externalities, meaning the decision maker doesn't capture all the benefits of using one format or another. They might be, but in many cases, through coordinated decision making, these externalities can be fully internalized and all of the benefits captured by the decision maker. The fact that even in those cases we don't see much switching suggests that maybe the market is choosing standards in the first place that are really pretty decent. Okay, so just to conclude, I talked a little longer than I wanted to. Network effects are important. They're particularly important in technology markets, but they aren't new. There's nothing especially new or novel about network effects. Network effects are not necessarily externalities calling for some government policy response. And, you know, from everything we know about how markets work and how public policy works, you know, standard setting by market actors is probably better than the feasible alternatives. Okay? So let me stop there and have a drink of water and then answer some of your questions. Okay, I'm going to scroll up in the chat room a little bit to see if there are any questions that I should still answer. For some of them, the moment has passed. But please feel free to add new questions now. Let's see. There's some references early in the thread to articles, Reisman, and so on. Definitely check those out. Some people who like Bruce Benson and his work on particularly his book, The Enterprise of Law. Morrow has raised the point that, you know, look, there are lots and lots of standards, technology standards, that emerge, you know, in a purely decentralized, voluntary manner through voluntary standard setting. Morrow mentioned, the USB format, but right, I mean, formats for reading and writing compact disks, lots of input-output protocols and so on, are chosen by standard setting boards, IEEE, industry groups, and other associations that seem to do a pretty good job of doing this, right? So if it's in the interest of participants in a particular industry to have a common standard, if there are benefits from standardization, well, people can get together and decide what standards they want to use. The market is very good at providing, as coming up with those kinds of things. Let's see. There's some points here about coding. Programming languages are examples of standards with network effects. Right? One thing that I think is interesting, if you compare programming languages to natural languages, you know, English or German or whatever, you know, natural languages that emerge in an almost completely decentralized fashion are typically much broader and much larger and much more general than programming languages, which have a lot more deliberate coordination, right? So it is possible for one person or a handful of people to write a programming language, though all the good ones, you know, Unix and so on, even, Microsoft's OS and so on, you know, they do involve the participation of hundreds and thousands of people, but there is a lot more central coordination. So in a sense, you can design a language from the top down, but that only works, you know, for sort of specialized technical purposes like programming. You guys remember Esperanto, the attempt by a few experts to design a general universal language from the top down? It was a total flop, right? It just isn't possible to have a language that is as flexible and sophisticated as a true natural language that's designed by a group of experts. Okay, let's see. Questions. A lot of comments about, I'm a little bit, I always try to provoke Mac enthusiasts with my disparaging remarks about the early Macintosh. I mean, you can take some of it as tongue in cheek. I mean, I really do mean that in the early 80s, it's not at all clear that, Mac OS was better than, IBM PC, MS-DOS, and so on. Of course, now we have a lot of convergence, right, where the benefits of the Mac OS, you can use the Mac OS on a Mac, but you can use Windows, you can use MS Windows, or you can use any number of the graphical user interfaces that run on top of Unix or Linux, and get kind of the benefits of the Mac OS type of system without buying a Mac, right? So there's been a lot of convergence suggesting that, people really do prefer graphical user interfaces to simply typing at the command prompt for most purposes. But the market, it turns out, was able to achieve that pretty well. It isn't obvious that Microsoft's share of the market today, relative to that of Apple, represents a kind of market failure or a kind of inefficiency, right? Again, if we look from the point of view of the market, the typical consumer, rather than the point of view of the techie or the engineer or the Mac cultist or whatever. Okay. Okay. Ian is asking about network externalities and network effects. Yeah. I mean, Ian, the point I'm trying to make is that in many cases, there is an externality, right? In the sense that my choice to, on the margin, my choice to join Facebook rather than MySpace or some other system, right, does increase the value of Facebook for the people already on it. And I don't necessarily get a direct benefit from doing that, right? I get an indirect effect from being part of a larger network. But the fact that my action is making somebody else better off, I don't get any direct benefit from that. The other person doesn't pay me. So there is an externality in that sense. My point is simply that network effects, the value of the network, depending on the size of the network, sometimes can be fully, the benefits sometimes are fully captured by individuals like in the typing pool case. Right? There are a lot of examples of companies forming themselves into alliances, joint ventures, other kinds of formal networks, precisely to internalize these externalities. Right, a group of companies join a consortium or form a particular alliance where they say, look, we'll make decisions about standards and other practices that benefit all of us, but we'll jointly decide through a commission or voting or whatever, and we'll make sure that the benefits are equally shared. People will pay in and they'll get a certain payout or whatever. In other words, network effects are not necessarily externalities, though they may be externalities as well. Do strangers benefit from me joining Facebook? Well, I mean, they might. It depends on the context, right? So Facebook involves not only network effects that the user does internalize, but also some network effects that the user doesn't, right? So yeah, I mean, just the fact that there's N plus one people on Facebook may increase the price of advertising, which provides benefits to Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook shareholders and whatever. And they don't pay me for that, right? So yeah, my joining may benefit the owners. It may benefit other users. It also benefits my friends. And there might be a way for me to share those benefits in a reciprocal fashion from my friends. Okay, so it depends on the context, right? I'm simply saying that the presence of network effects does not call for any particular public policy response. Okay. Danny has a question about typing. Yeah, I mean, internet protocols, well, we'll talk about TCP/IP and some of those things next week. A lot of the important internet protocols did not arise through a spontaneous process. They're not like Menger's emergence of money or the emergence of natural languages and so on, because those were set by a small group of specialists acting outside a market context. People working for the Defense Department, DARPA, the RAND Corporation, a few state-supported universities, and so on. So a lot of those internet protocols are not kind of the products of the market, as we'll see next week. But there are a lot of conventions, right? So Danny's saying, if we eliminate HTTP or replaced it with a smaller protocol, a shorter protocol, would there be benefits that technology providers, network engineers, and so on could appropriate? And I think, yeah, there's certainly maybe cases where they can do that. There's a lot of necessary coordination for internet and any kind of network communication, right? I mean, people are a lot of people are worried now about the switch to, or about running out of IP addresses, so-called IP4. So you know that internet addresses, there are four groups of numbers. I guess each one goes from 1 to 256. When those protocols were set up, no one imagined that your refrigerator would have its own IP address, and so we're running out of addresses. There's an attempt to switch to a new model, so-called IP6, in which there'd be more longer IP addresses. Now, switching to a different format requires a lot of coordination among network providers, companies like Cisco that operate routers, domain name servers, software providers, hardware providers, and so on. But the gains from switching in that case could be pretty substantial. And we don't have, so far it's been purely voluntary bodies that have talked about making the switch to IP6. And so it's not at all clear that you would need sort of state-sanctioned coordination outside of a market setting to be able to get that to happen. And maybe it could be the same thing with changing to // instead of HTTP// and so on. Other questions or comments about networks, about network effects, what's old and what's new, comparative advantage, and so on, are really questions about anything that we've been talking about in the course. While you're thinking and typing, I'll scan to make sure I didn't miss anything else. Here's a question from Matthew. As networks grow and drive alternatives out of the market, are they constrained by the calculation problem in the same way that firms are? Yeah, Matthew, I think that's a great question. I think the answer is yes. I'm glad you raised the point. Rothbard developed an argument that I myself have adopted and extended a little bit, especially in my 1996 article called Economic Calculations and the Limits to Organization, of how the need for market competition, the need for private property exchange and pricing, the need for social appraisement constrains not only the centrally planned economy, but also constrains the size of the firm, right? As firms grow, as they become larger, if they vertically integrate, if they merge with rivals and so on, then they too begin to suffer from the problem of inefficient resource allocation within the firm. Right, so we never need to worry that in the free market, lots of big companies will start to consolidate and they'll merge, they'll acquire each other until eventually we're left with just one giant firm on the free market. That would never happen according to Rothbard's argument, because as firms grow, eventually they reach a point where they simply cannot allocate resources efficiently internally, because they're suffering from the same calculation problem that besets the planners of a socialist economy. So Matthew's question is, could you have the same thing in a, say with social networking? Could Facebook get so large that it becomes inefficient that it's unable to calculate, to allocate resources within its operations. Maybe Google is a better example. As Google branches out into providing a number of different services, not only search, but of course all the other things that Google provides, could it eventually become so big that it can't calculate and that it is, you know, outcompeted by smaller, more nimble rivals? I mean, sure, that's definitely a possibility. You know, how close are we to that? How likely is it? Well, it's impossible to say. But only the market, only market competition can sort of demonstrate where that limit point is. But, you know, I think with Google and Facebook, I think they're probably pretty far from being constrained in that way. Because remember, you know, there are these interactions or complementarities between software and hardware, between, thing, what the end user sees and kind of the back-end infrastructure. So, you know, even Google only works because it's embedded in this large network with many, many other providers of, you know, the hardware on which Google services are accessed, the, you know, network infrastructure that runs in the background, you know, none of which is owned by Google. Maybe if Google starts owning backbones, if Google starts owning routers, if Google starts making its own computers and phones and so on, no, and we're not far off from that, then maybe it would be a different story. But I think we're not quite at that point yet. But I think it's a really great, it's a great question, Matthew. Okay, yeah. Fortunately, you don't have to do too much typing of http://// these days. But, you know, but again, look, the general point is, if the savings from switching to alternative programming conventions are large, right, then within open source communities, and certainly within proprietary programming communities like Microsoft, it's possible for decision makers to capture enough of the benefit from changing the standard that we would fully expect them to do it when it is beneficial for them to do so. In other words, the market is pretty good at figuring this kind of stuff out. So, okay, well, everybody, it's 8:30, or sorry, it's 9:30 Eastern, 8:30 my time. I haven't eaten dinner yet, and we've had a great discussion, but I think it's a good time to pull things to a close. So remember that we'll have our office hour time at 10:30 Eastern on Friday, and we'll have another little quiz available for you to do over the weekend. As always, we'll continue the discussion in the forums where you can ask questions, comments, discussions. Don't forget about the extra credit activity of participating on the Mises Wiki, and feel free to email me at pkline@mises.com or pkline@missouri.edu anytime during the week with any comments, questions, problems, or issues. So anyway, good night, everybody. I hope the next time we communicate, I won't be snowbound, and hope you all have a good rest of the week wherever you are. Bye-bye.